Welcome. So this is a Clear Mountain Wednesday interview, and today we're joined by Francisco and Rachel. Thank you so much for joining us, both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
So a brief bio. Francisco Gabel has been devoted to the Dharma teachings and practices since 2003. Thanks to this, he made an unexpected recovery from an accident that left him with permanent chronic pain and disability. Prior to his life-altering accident, he was a senior director in the technology industry in San Francisco. At present, he's a teacher in training at the Insight Meditation Center. Francisco was born in the Dominican Republic and reared there until immigrating at 10. Rachel Lewis began practicing insight meditation in 2003 while completing her physics PhD at Yale. Since 2011, she has taught Dharma and meditation classes and retreats in British Columbia and beyond. She completed the IMS IRC 4-year teacher training in 2021 and is a guiding teacher of the British Columbia Insight Meditation Society. Both are helping co-lead the new Brahma Viharas and Emptiness course based on the Compassion and Emptiness book by Bhante Anilio at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, which is planned for the spring of 2025. And we were just really happy to bring you both on to talk about this practice, this course, and also just to get insight into both of your lives and ways of living as lay Dharma teachers as well. So thank you for joining us. So a first question, I suppose on topic would just be if you, either of you or both of you, could describe the gradual descent into emptiness. What is this practice? Let's start with Francisco.
Okay, we didn't select. Is this all sounding okay? I just thought, okay, the echo's gone. Great. So the gradual descent into emptiness is, well, put it simply, it's about simplification of experience and finding a way to abide into emptiness in a way that is very actually accessible in daily life. And then the other side of it is that it's a doorway into the deepest teachings of our practice, of our tradition. It's a doorway into awakening itself. And the course that we're doing follows this discourse called the Minor Discourse on the Descent into Emptiness. In Pali, it's the Chula Sunyata Sutta. And there, it's a typical Buddhist setting. The Buddha's got a bunch of monks and he's taking them into a meditation. I'm paraphrasing a little interpretation. And then he guides them through a series of perceptions that get simpler and more refined. He starts with the perception of being out there in the forest together, for example. And then he goes gradually and further into the mind, letting them go into the perception of, well, each of these perceptions are very broad and unitary. So the idea is to make them simpler and more encompassing so that they occupy more and more of the mental experiential space so that we can see how we construct and then how all those constructions can dissolve into these big perceptions. So the perceptions are very broad. So the perceptions that we're focusing on in the course are infinite space, and then infinite consciousness, and then the perception of nothingness. And in this course, we're looking at the concentration of signlessness instead of in the sutta, it says neither perception nor non-perception. So each one of those just gets broader and vaster and more ultimate in a certain experiential sense until we get to signlessness, which is really we're at the door of awakening at that point.
And Rachel, how would you supplement? Oops, my mic dropped. Rachel, how would you supplement that explanation? And what else would you, how would you flesh out any of those steps?
Yeah, thanks. So this, we're step by step, we're noticing the yeah, this simplification of experience, we're turning towards, on a perceptual level, the emptying out of different kinds of complication, from the sort of gross level complication of village life with its hustle and bustle, and back in the day, horses and elephants, and nowadays, cars and trucks. So noticing the absence of that once you've gone to a quiet place, and allowing the mind to become more and more deeply secluded, to let go of more and more, even letting go of any appropriation of experience. So letting go of the concept, this is my awareness, this is my consciousness. And that's a really interesting step to me, because I've been on a lot of Buddhist meditation retreats where people have said, you know, be the awareness. And, you know, the Buddha is kind of saying the opposite, like, don't even be the awareness. Don't even be the one to whom this is happening. Letting go even of that level. I think one thing maybe to highlight is that in this sutta, we're talking about these experiences as perceptions. And as Francisco mentioned, the final one is a signless concentration experience. But this list lines up with what's known as the immaterial jhanas. And, you know, we're not necessarily practicing in these absorptive experiences. We're taking a, you know, fairly ordinary level of settledness of the mind and turning it to these perceptions. And maybe broadening out from the what it is to what this is for. Like Francisco said, you know, this final step takes us at the threshold of awakening. But these states in themselves are, you know, they're beautiful, sublime states. These especially, you know, the absorb the immaterial jhanas, you know, they're these refined states of deep peace. And the Buddha mastered them before his awakening. These are not, you know, it in themselves. And so in this sutta, this guided meditation that the Buddha gave to Ananda, he's showing, you know, how these states are still dukkha, you know, where the weariness, where the rub still is in all of these states, so that we can understand more clearly, how our constructed experience consists of complication by contrast with these deeply simplified states.
Yeah, we'll definitely want to go into each of these different spheres, these different stages along the path, this descent into emptiness a bit more deeply, and also really touch on the somewhat unique aspect that Bhante and Elio points to, is that these can just be perceptions more than, you know, jhanic, you know, having to be the formless jhanic attainments. But before going into that, I'm curious if maybe, Rachel, if you could just speak to what is the format of the course. I know people who watch our channel have maybe been to Goenka retreats. Those are very common. They may have been to in-person spirit rock retreats. They may have visited monasteries. And what is going to be the form of this retreat? And if you could speak to that a little bit, that would be helpful, give people some context.
Yeah, absolutely. So this course that we're developing is more like a study program that is heavily rooted in the experience, you know, the experience of this meditation. There's two prerequisite courses. There's the way that Analio teaches the Satipatthana Sutta, and the way that he teaches mindfulness of breathing. And so this course will be structured similarly to those ones. So you're sort of got wraparound learning components. So there's Analio's guided meditation. There's a video lecture that he's recorded for each of the six steps. Then there's a discussion board with questions to kind of, you know, help you probe your learning a bit more. And then the centerpiece is a live weekly session with a small group of about a dozen people, usually facilitated by somebody like Francisco or me. We've got a really great group of people who've been trained up to lead these sessions. And so for an hour and a half every week, you'll be live with the same group of people meeting on Zoom and talking about how your practice is going, talking about what you're learning in the practice that week. Kind of troubleshooting and deepening your understanding together in these small group discussions. So it's a very, the success of the course really depends on people's commitment to giving it their all, to really showing up well prepared for all of those small group meetings so that everybody can kind of rely on each other's learning and growth together.
So just in terms of what it would look like to be prepared, sort of broadening out a little bit again, I think some people might hear these states of the base of, you know, we've read about the base of infinite space and infinite consciousness. And I think many people's eyes would, you know, glaze over or become just quite intimidated. I mean, they seem so distant. And yet, as Ajahn Kovilo said, these can be used just as objects of perception without a complete absorbing into them. So just to ground this, you know, conversation in how would you guide someone briefly, Francisco, in terms of moving to, say, the first formless, or at least that perception of the base of infinite space? Like, what instructions would you give someone who's just watching this interview and wondering about that step?
And also, someone in the chat actually asks, what is perception? Can you define the word without actually using the word?
Yeah, that's a very helpful question to begin with, because to jump to the very end, the whole path, the way we simplify experience is by understanding our perceptual process, essentially how we use perceptions to make concepts, how we use a label for something that we recognize and then make up a perception around the label. My extra pair of glasses that just happens to be here. So this shows up and I recognize it and I have a perception. This is something that I put on my face. This is something that I take off. All those are perceptions. So they're labels that we recognize. So they're how we construct everything. And it becomes very subtle and automatic, and we're continually building perceptions. And the real trick and why perceptions are so significant is that much of the time, not all always, but much of the time, perceptions are linked up with those three underlying tendencies that are unwholesome. Aversion, greed, hatred, and delusion, to put it more crass. So because it's really good to see that they are very involved in this practice, this is really, I think, the meat of the practice, to see how we are continually constructing and how we can deconstruct our perceptual process to get more to clarity, like clear mountain, and and have peace and have ease and free from those sticky things that we get stuck to that are painful, that are just almost automatically the habits, the affinities, the habits of all those things that we're always kind of clinging to us. They happen through perception. So it's a very potent way to do Buddhist meditation and to achieve great mindfulness. It comes down to something pretty basic. And I hope that's enough. Your questioner can say more if they want more on that. But perceptions are what we go into. We continually build this practice, how we take someone into perception of space. In this course, because following Bhikkhu Nilaya's approach, we have already developed the Brahma Viharas, we have already developed a full experience of all four Brahma Vihara states. And Bhikkhunalaya takes it even further. He, in the first meditation, we practice the Brahma Viharas, and then in the second Brahma Vihara meditation, Bhikkhunalaya combines the Brahma Viharas with the awakening factors and the insight themes. That's all to say that it's a very evolved state of Brahma Vihara that we begin the descent into emptiness. And so there's been a big silencing of calming of all of the things that get calmed with the Brahma Viharas, the instinctual processes of reactivity, for example, ill will, and all those things that we begin to diminish and relax and soften, that really soften the selfhood around that we carry, or that carries us around. And so that's how we're beginning. So we're already beginning in this very open, spacious way, because the way that equanimity is experienced at a very evolved state is about space. It's a perception of space already that comes when we have really removed all our strong responses to things, and our strong reactions to things. We're able to just kind of have that tall, mountainous view of everything. Be like a mountain in a way. I like your clear mountain image. So, because it's such a classic image, because it's so useful to see that we can be as strong, as grounded, and unmoving as a mountain. So that's how we begin in that state.
So that was very helpful. And so what I'm hearing partly is, instead of entering to the base of infinite space through, or that perception through, the classic Chula Sunyata methodology of town to earth, then to space, we're taking a side door through metta and the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, and these vast spaciousness states. So I think many people will be familiar with those states, but, and maybe Rachel, you could speak to this. How does that key transition here between a Brahma Vihara and the perception of space, how does that occur? How would you guide people through that movement?
Yeah. So the way that Anallio teaches the Brahma Viharas is a bit different from those of us who've been on Western Insight Tradition retreats would be familiar with, where there, it's the Burmese method of using phrases and individuals. And Anallio focuses on how it was actually taught in the suttas, where it's a deeply simple practice of, you know, kind of abiding in this quality of metta or compassion or gladness or equanimity, as the case may be. And then just radiating it outwards. And so right there, you can see, even with metta, once there's that sense of the heart is boundless, you know, I'm not making distinctions between friend and enemy, between
Emily.
I have a friend named Emily, so I don't have not making distinctions between human and animal, radiating out in all directions. The heart that doesn't have any obstructions to this free flow of metta is kind of already boundless. And so when we're turning our attention to the perception of boundless space, it's just like, okay, so there is already this quality of boundlessness here. Let me just bring that into the foreground of my attention. And it's a really, you know, you could do it right now, like you could sense the space around you. You know, with the word space, you know, it could kind of seem like it's out there, like it's beside the moon or, you know, in the solar system somewhere. But there's space around our skin right now. Like, you know, as I move my hands, they're moving through space. And so it's this perceptual shift is similar to what you would do if you were looking at a page full of text and orienting to the text, and then shifting to orient to the blank space on the page. It's just like, what is it that I'm highlighting with my attention in this moment? And this is this shift to space in general is a deep simplification, because we can get so caught up in there's a thing there and it's a problem and I have to fix that problem, or I'm a thing here and I'm a problem and I have to fix me. And changing the perspective to, oh, there's all this space around these problems and the space isn't a problem. Like, even as I'm saying that, like, my shoulders are kind of dropping, right? Like, I don't need to fix space. And so the heart that started out friendly because of metta is now just so untroubled. And, you know, the way you can, Analio says it's okay to go right from metta to space. And the way he guides it in his recorded meditations, which are freely available in several places on the web, takes you through all four of the Brahma Viharas. And so with equanimity, there's already this like untroubledness that makes that shift really smooth. And I think, again, the reason for this sort of setup with metta, I'm blanking on his name, one of the early Westerners, ended up being a psychotherapist, maybe Jack Engler. So I had that great expression, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. And metta kind of helps us tease out all of the ways in which there are obstructions. There is a boundary in the heart. You know, I wish well to this kind of person, but not that kind of person. I wish well to myself, but not others, or others, but not myself. And we get to sort of metabolize some of that and, you know, build our capacity to be a kind witness to ourselves. You know, that ability to stay steady, even when stuff gets intense, really needs to be a well-developed ability before you start moving into emptiness. You know, there can be this, you know, if you're not ready for the emptiness practices, they can be very appealing. It's like, I have all of these problems and I just want to get away from them. Spend some time marinating in metta first. Once that heart is used to that boundless feeling of kindness, just unstinting, no conditions, no limitations, no, you know, loopholes or footnotes, just that's when it makes sense to move into the practice of emptiness. And, you know, while I'm on this, maybe I'll just say one other piece, which is that, so metta kind of grounds the practice of emptiness, and emptiness also strengthens the practice of metta. Yeah, there's that story of the cheerful monk who was asked, you know, why are you always so happy? And he just said, no self, no problem, right? And that sense of, what is there that could be obstructing my metta? You know, there's no trace of clinging here, even to my own awareness. You know, there's no appropriation of anything. So there's no way I could get into competition with anybody. So there's nothing that could block metta. You know, that's the potential for how this practice can, how these practices can enrich each other. You know, bringing this confident, kind heart into this, you know, loosening out practice, and then this deep simplicity of emptiness makes metta just so much more natural. Joseph Goldstein has that great expression, compassion is the activity of emptiness. It's like, once the heart is free from obstruction, it's just, it is responsive. That just is how the heart is.
Yeah, Rachel, I really appreciate just those very practical examples, noticing the space that's between us and the objects, which we seem to be so obsessed with, or the example of looking at the spaces between words on a page, or the silence between words when you're talking. There's an interesting thing that I noticed that when you talk with people who aren't Buddhist, you know, people who are new to the practice, who haven't read many suttas, they hear about the practice of spaciousness and emptiness. And especially with spaciousness, it's like, oh, that just intuitively makes sense. There are all these practical ways to do it. Whereas I've found when I talk to people who've read a lot of suttas and you talk about these perceptions of emptiness, they, you know, get a little bit tight and say, oh, so you're saying that anybody can do jhana practice or these really high states. So yeah, I think it's good to be able to reformulate. And there are places, the Kasinayatanas, the spheres of totality, which are mentioned, I think, seven times in the Digha and the Majjhima and the Anguttara, just listing the bases of boundless space and boundless consciousness as perception attainments that should be developed, not as such attainments that are only for people who've been meditating for 9 hours a day for 3 months. But maybe to go back to Francisco, maybe shifting from infinite space, boundless space, to boundless consciousness, what is this one mind, mind only transition?
So keeping it simple that we're trying to keep it simple that we're talking about perceptions. So we've taken on the perception of space, and that just means, to keep it in daily language, we've just made that our centerpiece. So we just how we meditate with the breath, and that can become our mainstay, our anchor, if you like that word, our home base. We make space our home base, allow it to suffuse through us, just like metta and the other Brahmaviharas were suffusing. So there's already this suffusion that's emanating from within and without, because we're organisms that are doing that, like the sun. We radiate, and the radiation is happening through us. So the suffusion of space is also about the space internally, because everything is actually made up of space. And so it gets very extensive. If you sit, you don't have to go for the immaterial sphere as an absorption, just practicing basically like we do with the breath, this infinity of space. And there's the conceptual infinity of space, and then there's also the experiential senses base of space. So once we've established ourselves in that perception, we notice that there is still hold, that there's, we turn to this, we do what Bhikkhu Nalayi calls it a U-turn. We begin to get a sense of what's knowing space, and how space is being known, and that it's a consciousness, that it's our, that aspect of our mind that we call consciousness, that is making up the perception of space. And he shows this very effectively in this demonstration of a video. He plays a gong, and I'll demonstrate, because I happen to have, bells don't work so well on Zoom, so I won't do that.
Give it a go.
Yeah, give it a go.
Restream, it might work. Let's give
okay,
it
a go. Okay, so here you go. Little bell, right? So now I'm going to request that you allow the bell sound to come toward you. Instead of extending your ear to go to the sound, as it were, allow the sound to come towards you. I'll do it one more time. Let it receive the sound. So sound can be very useful to see that there is a knowing of the sound that happens when we receive the sound, as opposed to how the perceptual process is working the majority of the time, which is going to the sound. Automatically we perceive, and it's always a looking to construct, as opposed to settling back and having this receptivity to connect with the consciousness that's making up the sound. And so we take the perception of space and what's knowing space. And by doing that, it's kind of like becoming spacious already, because we're knowing only space, knowing only space. And of course, other stuff can come up. Because there's always activity of mind to some degree or another. It's been calm, but this practice is to encourage to see and to know what also arises in the vicinity of this magnitude of space and knowing. And so knowing gets very, very elaborate because we have six senses of knowing. As we know, we in Buddhism, we have we see that we ourselves as being made up of six forms of consciousness, six senses, the usual five plus the mind. And so we can dwell on each element, each sense fully, and become aware that we are knowing everything in our mind, that there's actually no sound out there. The sound is being known in the mind, so it's being created in the mind. So it's that focus on knowing and knowing each of the contact that we make, each of the way the senses contacts us or we contact the senses. Does that help to, it gets a little refined and abstract.
That was very helpful.
Yeah, that was good. And that metaphor of the bell, the receptivity of just us hearing, it's a great metaphor that really helps. And just, I know some people get the U-turn. So it's like, you know, we're usually looking out this trajectory, this vector of awareness, but then turning it back to what is looking, this kind of finger pointing out at nothing. Or another trajectory example I've heard is like, rather than, you know, the aim of awareness just going out, it's just suck that arrow back in, and then it just doesn't go anywhere. I mean, you're staying with the base, the point that starts the whole arrow out.
It gets infinite very quickly.
And it gets infinite really quickly, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what we dwell on in the perception.
And we might move on to audience questions as well, but I am just quickly curious, have you had any students or yourselves worked with using the nada sound to move in those spaces or perceptions of emptiness or consciousness? The sound of silence taught by Longpo Sumedho, is that resonant with these concepts at all as well?
Yeah, Rachel, do you want to say something? Yeah, I've practiced with that extensively. Mm. Sound silence is amazing, is an amazing tool, because you really connect with the infinitude or through the silence. Silence is not silence. There is a tremendous amount of processing of this, of absolute silence that gets very exciting. And I've really connected with the knower and has made very clear, oh, there's a knower, there's a knowing, and it's all just being known. There's actually no difference between sound and silence in a certain way, at a certain level with silence, because it all melds.
I'm kind of smirking right now because that question links into one of my favorite wisdom teachings, which is the Winnie the Pooh stories. And in the final story, Christopher Robin says that his favorite thing to do is nothing. And he says, what nothing is walking along and listening to all the sounds you can't hear and not bothering. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually quite a beautiful description of, you know, the something akin to the mind state we're pointing to, where there's that attentiveness and not bothering, you know, that unruffledness.
That's beautiful. I heard a recent other Winnie the Pooh teaching on dependent origination, where it's Winnie the Pooh saying, the best thing in the world is honey. And they says, no, wait, it's the moment right before you've got the honey. And so much wisdom in the children's book.
Dada of Pooh. Please. So yeah, we'll just go to some questions which are in the chat. So this one is someone who's done the BCBS, that's the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies Path Progression Course with Bhante Inalio, and they're currently doing the year-long emptiness book by Rob Berbea, I think. Tuere Sala is involved with that. If you're either of you are familiar with Rob Berbea's book, Seeing That Free Is, maybe just I'll ask that first. Do either of you know that book well, and might you be able to compare that to Bhante Inalio's approach in compassion and emptiness?
Yeah, yes.
Go for it, Francisco.
Rob Ribera's book was very exciting. Well, There are, it's interesting, they're extremely different, doctrinally speaking, but they're also very similar because Robert Baer's teachings also bring in a strong sense of I don't know how to put it. I was going to say the love aspect, the Brahmavihara aspect is a centerpiece of how I think he teaches emptiness. But it's very different because Robert Baer's approach is looking at emptiness, at various kinds of emptiness, and emptiness for Brahmavihara, for in Analu's approach, Venerable Analu's approach is just one component of a whole sequence. So I'd just keep it there before getting too technical, because it can get very technical very fast.
And maybe just piggybacking on that, if you're taking that program with BCBS, which, you know, what seems like thousands of people are, don't take this course at the same time. It's just it don't muddy the waters. Like, just really get everything you can out of that course, and then maybe consider moving on to this one. Because like Francisco said, Analeo stays pretty focused on the early Buddhist definition of emptiness, which is always being empty of something. Mm. And so Rob Berbea and Guy Armstrong's book Emptiness sort of cast broader nets and look at different Buddhist traditions and different ways of experiencing this. But we're emptying out the experience of different forms of material complications, and then we're emptying out materiality itself, and then we're turning towards consciousness, and then we're emptying ourselves of any identification with consciousness, and eventually we're emptying ourselves of the defilements entirely. Mm. That's the deepest form of emptiness, is the uprooting of the tendencies to greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's a very direct thing. That specificity of being empty of something kind of makes it this way of talking about emptiness easier to get your head around, I think.
Yes, I know some more other formulations include, you know, Nagarjuna and the Madhyamaka school interpenetration, and it does seem like Bhante Analia's interpretation really keeps to the early Buddhist conception of being empty of blank, and replacing that blank with increasingly refined things until the end. So we have another question here. I'm struggling to understand how, without following the Eightfold Path, one can directly jump into the emptiness. Please explain. Francisco.
We mentioned that this course is preceded by two other courses, the first being Satipatthana, which the Eightfold Path is not explicitly taught, but the book that the course is based on covers the Eightfold Path, because the Eightfold Path is essential to any mindfulness practice. And I think that that's why we focus on the defilements so much, because of what Rachel just said, that is the supreme form of emptiness. And the course that we're co-creating right now, really week by week, keeps us pretty close to looking at ourselves pretty honestly, at how we have these unwholesome roots operating through us. And it provides, like Rachel just said, a great lens to see where we are not this way, where we're not free, where we're actually not spacious, where we are not openly conscious, where we are very attached to me and my thoughts, for example. So the course is very rigorously much based on walking the Eightfold Path.
And maybe just to piggyback on that, sometimes the term the Noble Eightfold Path can be a little intimidating. It's like, oh, I don't feel noble right now. So I like to think of it as like the good enough Eightfold Path. You know, like you need to have enough belief in cause and effect to get you practicing in the first place. You need to trust that it's possible to train the mind in order to start training the mind. And once that's in place, you know, the like working on the meditation piece or the wisdom piece inevitably will lead to a sensitization towards the ethics piece. Just like, you know, you at a certain point, you won't be able to avoid looking at how your actions affect, well, yourself, but also other people. And so, you know, just starting anywhere is inevitably going to end you up on the path if you keep walking with sincerity and curiosity.
This next question, wonderful. Can you give some examples of this, the pairing that you mentioned of each of the Brahma Viharas? That's the divine abidings, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity with the seven awakening factors of mindfulness, investigation, joy, energy, tranquility, concentration, and equipoise, and how this spans the experience towards emptiness.
Yeah, okay. So the way that Analio teaches this is, you know, this comes back to what I said earlier about, you know, there can be this inclination towards finding yourself a beautiful state, whether it's the sweetness of metta or the tranquility of, you know, the spacious awareness, and just kind of hanging on to it. Like, this is my calm. Nobody mess with my calm. And we're doing the opposite of that in this course. And part of that is bringing in the awakening factors from the very beginning, especially the investigation piece, just like checking and seeing. Like, okay, this, I'm abiding in boundless metta. Is there any, like being honest with myself, is there any trace of hostility here? Is there any ill will here? Kind of feeling into the way that these factors all come alive when any wholesome state is being cultivated sincerely. So there's the energy to maintain the state. There's the joy of having let go of the defilements that kept you from getting into that state. There's the tranquility of being there. There's the steadiness, the staying true to that experience, and the equipoise, the spaciousness of being in, let's stick with the metta example. And so we're practicing with all seven of those states in accompanying, you know, each of these steps through this practice, just like seeing, okay, are these, you know, is the mind in balance also between tranquility and, I don't know, intentness, the energizing awakening factors, right? So is that combination of clarity as well as the tranquility and settledness? Or have I gotten into sort of a cozy, dull state where I'm not really sure what's happening? Because that's not, it's pleasant, but it's not super useful. Or am I like so like intent about this moment that I've kind of lost sight of ease and steadiness? You know, could there be more receptivity here? So you could think of it in that simple way as just keeping the mind in balance as we're going through each of these steps.
Thank you, Rachel. Francisco, do you have anything to add on to that?
Well, yes, I'm happy to, since you asked. Each one of the awakening factors, just like Rachel was saying, comes in to unveil, reveal what can be revealed further for each one of us while in the sublime state. And they're designed to, because they have that energizing aspect and that calming aspect, to encourage in insight and also to encourage tranquility, which is one of the central themes of how Venerable Analayu teaches this class, teaches this practice, that makes it very different and really much more down to earth and applicable than practicing it as trying to practice it as an immaterial absorption. So we're always looking further and further at how my mind is and how free it is of whatever we want our mind to be free in terms of suffering.
Thank you, Francisco. And I'll just say, just from my own experience, practicing with these as perceptions, specifically boundless space, it is accessible and it is fascinating. And it's actually, I find it more interesting than the breath. And, you know, actually taking one of these perceptions, you can go, you can go and let the mind get very, very still, just with this as it's almost an immaterial object. But, thank you both for joining us. And we're going to go over to Zoom, where people are welcome to join us and to continue the conversation. I'm just going to paste the link into the chat. Rachel and Francisco, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
And we'll be pushing, posting in the description here some of the links to the courses, which Francisco and Rachel will be leading. And just really encourage people to take advantage of some of these. It's a powerful practice, and if it's being offered, then it's worth looking into. We'll also post links to those guided meditations from Bhante and Alia. So thank you so much, Francisco and Rachel, and please visit us if you're in Seattle. We'd love to see you.
Okay. Bye-bye. We'll see you. Thank you.